Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
China Scholars. He's a research associate at the China Center, Oxford University, and at the School of Oriental and African Studies, London. George was chief economist and senior economic advisor at UBS Investment Bank from 1995 to 2012. And I can wholeheartedly recommend his book to everybody, Red Flags, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy. Helen Zhao is managing director and chief economist for Greater China and head of Asia's economics research at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Based in Hong Kong, she has served as a China analyst at a number of venerable institutions and is one of the world's leading experts on the Chinese economy. Dave Rank served for 27 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, for many of them in China, including as deputy chief of mission and acting ambassador. He's one of America's most distinguished diplomats and China hands, and now works with the Cone Group, among other activities. So the first half of this session will be a discussion with the panel. I then will turn to a discussant and then open it up to audience questions, which can be submitted via the chat function. So let's open up. I'll give everybody about 6 minutes or so. And then I plan to turn to our first discussant, Stephen Schwartz, head of sovereign ratings for Asia at Fitch. George, there's much going on in China. President Xi has cracked down on the private sector. He has touted common prosperity. He's promoting dual circulation to make China more self-reliant. The authorities are trying to reduce leverage and the excesses of the real estate sector. And these events will have major implications for China's development and growth model. Could you tie these together for us? Tell us how they fit together. What does it all mean? And I was especially intrigued by an FT piece you wrote recently in which you said that what is happening in China isn't business as usual and investors should consider themselves forewarned. Maybe you could elaborate on all this for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Very good morning or good afternoon or wherever you happen to be. Thanks for the introduction. I'll try to do that in limited time before we get to kind of Q&A. I think I'd like to make a kind of a general point just by way of backdrop, really, which is incrementally and then rather more rapidly, I think. You know, the last few years have seen quite a significant turn away from the kind of market reforms that we came to expect almost relentlessly, really, in China over a long period of time. As the government has kind of ambitiously embraced control. I don't think I'd call it planning in the way that they used to do it decades ago, but certainly very pervasive intervention and strong embrace of hands-on management. And I think this is kind of in keeping, really, with the not just the continuing the legacy of very large control and discretionary power over the economy, but also the increased control which Xi Jinping has amassed since coming to power. Lots of things have kind of reinforced this kind of trend. I mean, I think the financial crisis in 2007, 2008 was a huge catalyst. The pandemic itself actually has proven to be a catalyst. And of course, in general, the kind of technological revolution that we're going through has been a catalyst for this. And it's given a spur really to the government to think that by taking state enterprises and party entities back to the commanding heights, so to speak, of the economy, that China has a kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity to establish, in effect, a return of its kind of global leadership and set its standards and values for the global system. Okay, quite an ethereal kind of political introduction, but I don't think you can understand really what's going on in China, or one can understand really what's going on in China without this kind of essential political backdrop. Much of this will be fleshed out at the forthcoming sixth plenum, which is taking place next week. And then there'll be much, much more of that at the National People's Congress next spring, and then the 20th Party Congress in November 2022, when, of course, as we will expect, Xi Jinping will be nominated to for a third and maybe a third term of office, but maybe many more after that. Who knows? So even before the aborted Ant Financial IPO last November, just to kind of condense the time period now into something that's a little bit more kind of real time. Even before then, you know, there'd been quite an active sort of discussion and debate really about the role of the private sector and the role of private firms. There had already been quite a strong emphasis on the establishment of party committees in all firms, private as well as public, of course, where there were more than three party members. These party committees sit more or less close to operational management, but increasingly close, I would argue. Party members were urged basically to become involved in staffing, recruitment, compliance, obedience. There was a conference of entrepreneurs that Xi Jinping chaired in July of 2020, where private firms were urged to fulfill not just their commercial and trading responsibilities, but also their moral and social responsibilities as well. This was all a little bit kind of vague at the time, but obviously it has been kind of fleshed out a little bit since the crackdown on a whole range of firms in this blizzard of regulation that we've had really during the course of this year. The counterpart of that also has been, of course, an emphasis on the role of the state sector, as I said before, not just in terms of investment by state enterprises, but the establishment of investment funds for state enterprises. The kind of concept of blended ownership, which was being touted only a few years ago about private companies taking stakes in state enterprises, has sort of been turned on its head a little bit, really, because the blended ownership really is now more about state enterprises taking stakes in private firms. The kind of list of companies that were previously identified, sectors that were previously identified as being essential for state control, which included anything connected to the military, power, oil and gas, telecoms, aviation and shipping, of course, have now been joined by a very special emphasis really on data platforms, artificial intelligence, anything that's kind of tech, fintech and so on. There is more of this is going to be fleshed out, obviously, as we go through the rest of this year and next year, along with other parts of what Xi Jinping has called loosely the kind of new development concept. So the deleveraging, which I'm sure we'll hear more about. I mean, I'm not going to speak greatly about this, but we could certainly talk about it later. And Helen and Dave may certainly want to do so. Deleveraging, particularly in the property sector, is seen as a sort of a national security interest. Dual circulation strategy, which was promoted last year quite loudly, is really sort of China's version of self-reliance. In a new era where it faces a very, very challenging, hostile environment. Common prosperity is now the kind of the new mobilizing slogan for the party and for citizens to attack inequality, both amongst citizens and amongst regions. We don't really know very much about common prosperity yet, other than it is a slogan and it will involve the taxation of capital and penalties for what they call unreasonable incomes. But it's certainly something which the party and Xi Jinping has given a lot of attention to, and which will be a guiding kind of principle, I suppose, in policies yet to be fleshed out. But I think my final comment really is to kind of pay a lot of attention to these things. I mean, not just common prosperity, dual circulation strategy and deleveraging and of course the kind of role of private firms, because I think by their own admission, really, I think China's leaders know that the development model needs a makeover, that the one that's been good for the last 20 or 25 years is no longer good for purpose. So the high saving, high investment, high debt model really has kind of run its course. But I don't think yet that the leadership has been politically able to articulate what it is that they want to replace it. They don't want kind of a Western style consumer oriented society. But somehow they have to change the balance of the economy between consumption and investment. And so far, I don't really see very much that's on the agenda to do that. So this will be a really important few months coming up and year leading to the 20th Party Congress. No doubt many details will be fleshed out about China's future direction. I don't really think the policy agenda, as far as we can see, and the political agenda, as far as we can see, gives us huge reason for optimism that that this new development model will actually work in the way that they want. Mark.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful lead in and a perfect segue to turn to Helen and put the same question that I put to George. And now you've heard George make some interesting remark. And I was going to ask you, and I think this is a natural follow on to what George said, about what the implications of all of these developments may be for China's sustainable growth. I expect a major slowing. Some of these developments may push the sustainable rate down even further, I would think. And that could have major knock-on effects, not only for the world economy. So I'd appreciate any thoughts you had on all of these issues. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mark, and great to hear what George was thinking. It was a great piece at FT, and I very much enjoyed reading it as well. So actually on China, I tend to agree with what George said. This is a very different cycle. It's not something that we have seen almost in the last 15, 20 years. Clearly that we have seen all the most important elements of a cycle, growth slowdown, you know, policy adjustment. You know, we believe that the policymakers have already been starting to do the fine tuning. However, I think this time around, clearly that the efficacy of policy measures that we have, policy easing measures that have been rolled out have been much lower than we had expected, or, you know, those that we have seen in the past cycles. So going back to what you said earlier, Mark, about, you know, the different kind of policy objectives, I think that's probably the most important difference this time around compared to before. So, you know, starting from earlier this year and throughout, you know, till now, I think we have seen the policy priorities shifting away from growth objectives and much more towards social objectives. So, you know, when you talk about the inequality and the ways to address it, we have common prosperity. When we talk about the environment issues and, you know, and also the carbon emissions, we have the decarbonization efforts. And, you know, properties needs to be for residential purposes or living purposes, not for speculation. Then you have the deleveraging in properties. So, you know, for quite an interesting, you know, I would say a sudden reversal in many ways, that policies in the short term have clearly deviated away from, you know, away from the kind of pro-stability approach and much more towards a highly safe mode, in the sense that, you know, we need to make sure that we don't want any of the risk that that we have on this list, right? That includes the high leverage risk, includes the carbon emission risks, that includes the inequality related risks that we saw from other political, you know, political turmoils anywhere in the world. So to make sure we don't have those risks, we need to be super careful, and we want to impose all these policy measures to make sure that none of this happens, right? But then as a result, when you are pushing a lot of things to the extreme and turning expectations very drastically, actually what we saw this year is that we ended up perhaps with higher risk rather than lower risks, as they originally, you know, these policymakers were hoping to achieve. So that's actually something I think is worth highlighting, you know, as the one of the drivers, as you mentioned, you know, why they were doing this. You know, policy complacency is another issue, which George touched upon as well. You know, first half was extremely, Goldilocks style, high growth, low inflation, 18.3% year-on-year GDP growth in Q1, 7.9% in Q2. That's almost, too good to be true. Of course, helped by the low base, but you know, it looks good on paper. At the same time, the complacency also comes from the pandemic itself. The ways that China has been addressing the pandemics has been, regarded the best, at least by Chinese, not only the government, but also most of the Chinese public, as the role model for everybody else. And how can their policies be potentially mistaken in any other ways? So, unfortunately, I would say that these are the possible drivers for what we have seen today. But on top of that, we also saw technical issues, which is just before the 20th CPC, the Communist Party Congress coming up next year. The reshuffling of the government from the different local government levels all the way to different ministries and higher up has already started from summer this year, and it will continue into next year. So everybody is now under the extreme scrutiny for what they have done. Obviously everybody wants to show that they are extremely supportive to the very top, top down approach of the policy directions. So everybody wants to contribute to it, and therefore they would like to add to those policies by patching up with more policy measures. And by adding so much more on top of something that is already, in place, and you have all these add-ons that basically, skew the risk towards over tightening or, over regulation. And as a result, we're seeing, all these changes this year, which is extremely rare in the last, two decades that we have been, kind of watching China so closely. But that said, going back to your question that what this means to the market and also the economic implications of these developments. The immediate impact is the growth slowdown, as you already pointed out. And market is fully, I wouldn't say fully pricing in, because I think different markets are pricing in different facts. If you look at the high yield, the property, developer names, in China, most of these US dollar denominated bonds are currently under stress. Not only the single B type, but also the double B type, very distressed levels, already trading at such levels. Evergrande hasn't defaulted yet, believe it or not. They have managed to pay the interest payment, even with a delay, but within the grace period. But interestingly, that we have seen so many others, quite a number of other private developers, basically fallen behind and now either filing defaults or, at the verge of doing that. And for such market, for high yield U.S. dollar markets, clearly that all this risk have been, basically showing up already, and we're seeing the knock-on effect as well. But if you look at the stock market and the general bond market, I don't necessarily think that investors are extremely worried yet. Yes, some of the names such as online education, such as internet, probably have been trading much lower than where it was at the peak level. But if you look at the financial institutions, right, they're still trading at reasonably high levels. Not compared to other countries, but compared to China itself, it's not necessarily too bad. So I don't necessarily think that a market has fully priced in or taken into the fact that, how much of the slowdown it is ahead of us. For example, Q3, right, we saw the GDP growth in year-on-year terms coming down to 4.9%. But we're expecting the fourth quarter year-on-year number to be at 2.6%. So is the world ready for a two handle of China year-on-year GDP, right, in the fourth quarter? And for next year, for 2022, our forecast is a 4.0%. And this, by the way, is not because that we're so bearish that we just want to talk about how bad things could become, and therefore this is the bearish scenario. It isn't. It is our baseline case. The bear case could be worse than this. So the baseline, in the baseline case, we're actually still expecting a sequential improvement from 3Q to 4Q. And, in fact, we are seeing some nascent signs of that in property related lending, as the news report seems to be suggesting it in October, better than September. Property sales doing a little bit better. And also, we're hearing that auto sales is doing slightly better, so less negative at least compared to what we saw back in September. So with all these recent changes, we're actually pretty glad to see that at least the sequential improvement is underway. But is there enough improvement to go through November and December so that we can actually start 2022 at a reasonably high note? We're not so sure. The reason is because that there is still a general lack of policy easing measures we were hoping for. You might be saying, what kind of easing measures are you talking about? We are expecting, well, as one of the few minority economists out there now in the fields, because most people have decamped and left because they got very disappointed. So we are still one of the few left who believe that there should be an interest rate cut and possibly reserve requirement ratio cuts before the end of the year. So you might be saying that is that going to be useful at all? I would say that, very cynically, I also have the same doubt. I don't necessarily think that, a triple R cut or an interest rate cut in LPR would necessarily make a much difference over there. However, if they don't do it, if they don't even do something, as obvious and evident as this, unfortunately, without a signaling impact, I'm not so sure if that would be the evidence of, generally speaking, policymakers not caring enough about the slowdown and willing to use the more policy tools to help stabilize the economy. That I think could be a general concern. So it's not so much about the measure itself, But without which, I think the problem is that we are going to question if they are genuinely concerned about this and would do something for it. For that, I would like to mention one more thing before I wrap up, which is I think generally speaking, the policy the policymakers' lack of reactions is probably related to the fact that they are seeing some of that being part of related to the COVID outbreak. For example, in September, when they look at August numbers, which was already pretty low in retrospect, compared to any other cycles, and policymakers told us that we're not so sure if it is because of the outbreak. But then when you look at the September number, right, in 2 weeks ago, then people still are very hopeful that they are going to do something. However, we ended up with no interest rate cut, no triple R cut, and growth levels of activity indicators such as industrial production, fixed asset investment were at such low levels that it's really hard to justify the lack of reactions. And also even verbally, there was very little rhetoric that comes out and suggests that people should come down, expectations should be relatively stable, nothing. So I would suggest that generally speaking, this is all, the red lights that are currently, starting to show that, risks are rising. And the very fact that most of us sitting within and outside of China are still expecting policymakers to be, making the timely moves to address all these concerns, given that they have so many policy tools, we need to reconsider whether they have a different plan. And for the rest of the world, I think a natural question would be, how come we don't feel it, right? If China is slowing down as much as what Helen is saying, then how come we don't feel that it is so bad? I think partly this is because that while China is importing much less in real terms, in nominal terms, it isn't because of the commodity price increases. And also at the same time, the global demand remains reasonably strong and China's export sector is still, you know, fared up. And therefore semiconductor related digital electronics demand is still so strong that you generally don't necessarily see that, for example, from Chinese imports from the rest of the world, especially from the rest of the region. But things are going to change. We don't necessarily think that, you know, that we're going to see such commodity, especially metal prices, staying at such elevated levels if China's demand is crumbling so quickly. And at the same time, how could we expect that everything would look, still so robust by the time that we see more central banks starting the tightening? Would say that China's slowdown would be potentially more concerning for markets and potentially for the rest of the world as well. But hopefully more people will start to look at this. Thank you.
Great. So let me turn quickly to Dave. How do you interpret these developments in common prosperity how should U.S. policymakers think and respond to the developments in common prosperity? Floor is yours.
Thanks, Mark. And thank you for letting me go third. I think it was George Shultz who said, you know, we're at the point of the meeting where everything has already been said, but not everyone has already said it. So I will try not to repeat all of the good points that George and Helen made and be very quick. I think, first and foremost, this is a domestic, this isn't really an international issue. This is a China domestic decision. What's going on in China? China's doing it for domestic reasons. And it's kind of interesting, the parallels between the conversation, really some of the conversations in China and in the United States, concern about rising inequality, growing economic disparity. This is a situation, though, where China, rather than being able to be a fast follower, has got to, you know, they are trying to deal with these issues at the same time. And so they're experimenting in different ways. And I think you're going to see sort of an addressing of inequality with Chinese characteristics. And, you know, George and Helen were both, I think, really accurate in their depiction of it, which is it will be much more state or party dominated than it would be in the rest of the world. There will be little recourse to legal channels as the government enacts measures to implement this common, I think very vague common prosperity approach. And there won't be all that much opportunity for public debate. You know, George, you said it, common prosperity is at this point a slogan. And I've always been struck by how, in retrospect, in hindsight, it's always, it's been very obvious. Of course, this is what they meant by the three represents, or in this case, common prosperity. I think in a couple of years, we will look back and say, oh, of course, that's what, you know, they've been so clear that Beijing was signaling this is what common prosperity was, because I think they'll experiment with a lot of different things. What works, they will incorporate into the canon of common prosperity, and what doesn't work will be put to the side. The question is it going to work? I mean, there are lots and lots of problems China's trying to deal with I think it's very much an open question that the laws of economics in some cases will allow this to succeed. I guess the relationship, although I think this is primarily a domestic issue, I think there are a couple of connections to foreign policy. One is, it strikes me as an echo of the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union of 50 years ago, when in addition to security and technological competition, there was a competition of the need to demonstrate that our systems, you know, that our respective systems worked better. And so, you know, that you saw in the United States legislation, an effort to make sure that people had, that capitalism could deliver for ordinary people. So, you know, whether it was Great Society or other efforts, you know, even back to the New Deal, sort of a common consensus that we had to show that capitalism worked for ordinary people. And I think that's what's going on now to some extent, is both China and the United States recognize that in a global competition, you have to show that your system works, not just for the country, but for the people who live there. As far as advice to American policymakers, I would say, you know, we should view this as primarily a Chinese domestic issue. I mean, obviously, it's going to affect Americans, as Helen said, you know, to the extent it affects global demand. And George, as you alluded, the extent to which it affects American or non-Chinese investors. I guess my response to that is we should be hesitant to take highly interventionist responses that you know, the market should price these things in, price in the rising political risk of investing in China. And I think to some extent that's happening. And I think to some extent that will continue to happen. And I think the markets will be a better, will do a better job of making those adjustments than people sitting in Washington. With that, I know I will endeavor to get us back on time, Mark. So maybe I'll kick it back to you as host. Thanks.
Well, thank you for that. Let me turn to our first discussant, Stephen Schwartz, who's head of Asian Sovereign Ratings for Fitch. And based in Hong Kong. So, Stephen, please, what are your reactions to what you've heard? And do you have any questions, hopefully hard questions for the panelists?
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for anointing me as discussant. I think all three speakers hit on the key issues of the very same set of issues that we at Fitch Ratings are scratching our heads over and trying to discern. I'd make just a few points by way of summary and then pose a couple of questions to the panel. The first, I guess, is everybody on the panel agrees that a dramatic slowing is underway in China. And that does concern us, not only for Chinese growth, but the spillovers potentially that it has to the region's economies and the global economy. We have lowered, like others, our full year growth forecast for this year and next, but not by very much. And the reason we haven't lowered them by very much is we've expected a recalibration of policies along the lines that Helen mentioned toward support. And why do we expect that? Well, that's what we've been used to seeing. When growth slows, you see a very pragmatic approach to policy where the authorities often step back on some of their longer term goals if they think they're overdoing it and risking growth. But that's not happening this time. So we're sort of proverbially waiting for Godot as we're waiting for those triple R cuts that Helen mentioned. We're still penciling that in. But it makes me wonder if they're going to lower the triple R, why they haven't done it yet. So something is going on, which is, I think, the second theme of all three speakers, that there is something of a paradigm shift underway, and we need to really rethink what the authorities' policy reaction function is and what it's likely to be going forward. Now, you know, I think George spoke to some of the glass half empty aspects of what's going on. But from a credit perspective, if this common prosperity drive is implemented successfully, it's actually positive for longer term sustainable growth. You know, let's be careful what we wish for. We've all been concerned in recent times that policy stimulus goes too far in China, that we get episodes of fiscal easing and credit growth that causes leverage to rise. Well, this time we're not getting that. We're seeing a great deal of policy restraint. The overall leverage ratio this year has come down somewhat, thanks in part to high nominal GDP growth. And all of this focus on income inequality, if implemented well through progressive taxation, rolling out a social safety net is exactly the kind of thing that could be beneficial for long-term sustainable growth. I guess the last point I want to mention, and this is really the questions I posed to the panel, what does this paradigm shift mean exactly? Clearly, there's a reorientation away from focus on growth targets and toward quality of growth, a term that's been used repeatedly in the past, but toward income inequality. But what does that mean exactly? Does that mean other objectives that we weren't really factoring into our analysis that go beyond even quality of growth, but to more, as George said, a return to sort of the roots of a more Maoist policy approach in terms of influencing the way people think? Is that what's at play? And what does it mean for policy implementation and coordination? You know, Helen talked about a top-down approach to policymaking. On the one hand, that enhances the effectiveness of policymaking when it's highly centralized. But as the economy's grown so large and become so complex, you can get real policy missteps and a lack of coordination. So I'd be interested in what the panel thinks of that whether we're in for policy missteps and, you know, the kind of policies we're seeing with respect to the Evergrande case. Are the authorities ready to provide liquidity where it needs to be, when it needs to be? And lastly, this question about the role of the state. You know, a lot of what's in Xi's speech, if you read the speech that kicked this off on August 17th, is exactly the kind of policy platform that, say, Bernie Sanders might like very much. It's a real redistributive approach to income equality. And some of it is very standard economics, frankly, when it comes to progressive taxation, social safety net, and redistribution policies. But what's in store for the role of the state in all of this? If the role of the state takes a front seat once again, how can China promote innovation and boost the productivity that's mentioned in Xi's speech? That's a big question we have. So those are a couple of the questions I put on the floor for the panelists. And Mark, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, that was excellent. For a second panelist, I am going to call for very briefly to my longtime colleague and good friend, Bob Doner, Treasury Department's Mr. Asia for ever so long. Bob, floor is yours.
Well, a lot of the points that I would make have already been made. I think like Dave Brank, I think this is largely a domestic issue. It's a Build Back Better for All Chinese kind of program. It's addressing a lot of perceived inequality issues, including what has become a private tutoring arms race among urban households for educational advancement. I think the Chinese have extensively studied the problems of advanced economies, particularly competition policy and platform economics and their effects on domestic economies, both as a matter of power, but also as a matter of competition and widespread prosperity. One of the things I think it's also a turn towards greater state intervention, a greater state guidance of the economy, but not a return to Maoist policies or a challenge to private ownership and the market. Two things that strike me, and I'll finish. One is I think the Chinese have this decision-making system has so centralized under the Xi administration that there is little consideration or weighing of policy options. And you get policies that are, in the words of Chinese bureaucrats, blunt and severe, with relatively little, a relative indifference towards the effect on markets and market prices, something that's horrified Western investors. And the second thing that strikes me is that the growth target has traditionally been something to be met, but it's clear now that it's something that doesn't have to be exceeded or much exceeded. the Chinese are taking advantage of the fact that there'll be a rapid rebound from 2020. The annual growth target will easily be met. They're in the midst of a fairly substantial fiscal consolidation and taking a number of policy efforts that will affect the economy, affect growth. What strikes me as a question for the panelists is, are they introducing more variability, more volatility in the underlying economy and the underlying policy measures that will play out in cycles over the next few years?
Thank you, Bob. Excellent question. So I encourage people to submit questions. Some have been submitted, but just following on some of the basic themes I've heard, I know Hung Tran had a quick question that I felt was very consistent with much of the discussion. So Hung, could you pose your question for us?
Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you very much for the panelists and the two discussions. My questions follow very nicely from the last two speakers. Basically, we are looking forward to more information, more measures from China, from the Plenum and Party Congress to fully understand where China is headed in the foreseeable future. And therefore, what we have known so far in the past year is very much depending on the context of how you put them. And I think that the context is very clear. Either you see them as a reversal of the liberalization that we have seen in the past 20, 30 years that bring prosperity to China, and therefore moving away from that would lead to doom and gloom. Or we see what Xi is trying to do now is really to address, abate in a very autocratic manner, all the excesses of the past model that are also seen elsewhere in the Western world. If we see in that way, then the moves that we have seen are welcome, if not overdue, and therefore, of course, depending on implementation. But if they are implemented somewhat right and produce results, I think it will make the China's model even more sustainable and continue to grow well into the future. So I think that, we should keep in mind that the cult of personality of Xi Jinping is quite disturbing on the one hand, but on the other hand, his measures, in my view, have been quite popular with most of the population in China, particularly the crackdown on high tech and billionaires in China. So I think that overall, the context is key, and I would like to hear how the panelists more firmly say which way they are thinking in terms of context.
Thank you, Hung. So we're getting a bunch of questions in. I think what I'm going to do is just take all the questions and then save as much time as I can at the end for the panelists. So I'm going to take three more questions and I urge everybody to be quick. So the first is Jean-Remy Lopez. Would you like to unmute yourself and pose your questions? And I think some of these are going to go Dave's way. Mr. Lopez from DTCC, would you like to ask your question? There you go.
Yep. Hi. Hello. Yes. So I have a couple of questions. The first one is to what extent have the pandemic measures, especially the sanitary ones, served as non-tariff barriers to policy objectives? So, for example, you can imagine that some of these barriers may have been erected under the cover or under reasons of COVID, but in reality are advancing policies such as dual circulation. And the other thing is that in the U.S., we see a lot of the policymakers and the politicians seem to be united on one topic, which is, I'll call, assertiveness against China, to not use a more aggressive term. How will this affect the U.S.'s ability to develop policies that are more objective and that are successful in the long term? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter McBeath. Peter?
Thank you. Yes, the Chinese senior industrialists are looking to come out to different countries on large-scale objectives in their discussions, and we're talking bigger than the current imports from the Greek shipping industry, for example. So for international distribution, they got to be careful not to impede these trade opportunities, because we're talking tens of billions a month for their economies and theirs. So we'll be looking at ensuring that this is made as smooth as possible.
Thank you for that. Munir Majid, could you pose your question very quickly?
Thank you. I just wonder what the ramifications are of China's internal changes to its relations, of course, with the U.S., but in particular, I would like the panel to reflect on its relations with ASEAN in Southeast Asia. I mean, there's been a whole series of summits that were held at the end of last month, and at the same time, it's the first time the U.S. president actually participated actively in these summits, albeit virtually. Would this, for example, be a good time for the U.S. to come up with some more initiatives rather than just political security ones, you know, to implant its or to strengthen its relationship with ASEAN on the economic front? At the same time, I think, would China, on the other hand, as is often stated, with its domestic tightening, become more bellicose, in terms of its external relations, of course, Taiwan being at the forefront of one's mind in terms of its external expression. Thank you.
Great. Okay, last question, Andrew Fennell, can you pose your question very quickly?
Yeah, sure. Hi, good evening all. Helen, just a quick one for you. I put it here, how big of a growth issue do you foresee next year if we don't get the rate cuts that you are currently expecting? I think we agree on our end that the policy signaling is quite important, especially because some developers and high-yield issuers are having trouble accessing markets at the moment.
Great. Okay. We're going to go to the panelists. I guess I can go same order I had before. Give each about 4 minutes to offer comments on the questions, anything else they're thinking on. So George, floor is yours.
Thank you. I think I'll leave the US related in the interest of time and brevity to Dave, actually. But I'll pick up the Hong Trang's question. And also a little at the last question about whether China is kind of reversing liberalization or addressing the sort of excesses of the old model and so on. I mean, inevitably, I'll give you an economist's answer, which is both, right? So, I mean, what I think China is backing away from is the pragmatism of the party that was a hallmark of the Deng Xiaoping era and leaders that followed for decades, really. It was, you know, just the ability, or not the ability, but the willingness, basically, to give the private sector room to develop, I mean, within confines, of course, because it was always a state-controlled, party-run system. But the private sector had, you know, became the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 sector, according to Liu He, you know, is 50% of tax revenue, 60% of GDP, 70% of innovation, 80% of production, 90% of firms, and so on and so forth. So this, I just think that this is an era of kind of untrammeled kind of private sector led growth, which has now come to an end, really. I started off my comments by saying that, you know, that we'd reach the end of sort of liberalizing market reform. Reform hasn't ended, but liberalizing market reform, I think, has. I just have this kind of strong sense, really, that the Xi Jinping era is a very different one. It's about establishing a very different type of governance model, which has huge implications for the development of China's institutions, the development of China's institutions in turn has very huge implications for what happens to productivity, which is the kind of the holy grail that we're all after. And I don't think that the capacity for innovation, I mean, I'm not saying the Chinese can't invent good stuff, because they do and they can. But innovation is basically about business. Business is about management, organization, about, doing good things, smart things with resources that are a limited supply. And I think that you're in effect stifling the innovation by removing the capacity for the private sector to be run in the way that entrepreneurs do. I mean, not all firms have to be punished. The United Front Work Department is well versed in trying to align the interests of non-party members with the interests of the party. And I think this is how they propose to get the private sector to behave in a way which removes capitalist excess and also to align the private entrepreneurs and billionaires and so on with the interests of the party. One final comment on common prosperity. I think it was said that, you know, if it's implemented successfully, you know, it could be a very important development in sort of China's medium to long-term success and development. This is the whole problem. You know, what is to be implemented successfully? Because you can't just sloganize equality between people and between classes and between regions. And there's nothing so far that suggests how the government might choose to make the tax system more progressive. You know, 5% of tax revenues come from income tax. Most of them come from very regressive forms of taxation, including VAT. There's nothing on the program about creating a welfare economy. In fact, government officials have been adamant about the fact that they don't want to create a welfare system that Western democracies or liberal-leaning democracies are familiar with. Nothing about educational reform. You know, the wonderful book by Scott Rosell and Natalie Hell that came out this year called Invisible China explains to us how, you know, only 30% of China's labor force has high school qualifications or better, which is very, very low for a middle-income country. So, you know, centralization, you know, nothing on redistribution, nothing on tax reform, nothing on hukou reform, nothing on social security. I mean, these things are all huge gaps for a development model that needs a makeover, but without articulation as yet. So we'll see. But I'm not that optimistic at this point in time.
Helen, a lot of food for thought here.
Hi, sorry, I was turning around. Can you hear me now?
Absolutely, loud and clear.
Okay, great. I would pick up maybe some of the questions that George didn't answer. The last one, for example, on what happens if there's no rate cut and to 2022 GDP growth. I think it really depends on what they do outside of the monetary policy. At the moment, we see very limited willingness in terms of moving any of these three pieces of chess. One is monetary policy, in terms of interest rate cuts, reserve requirement ratio cuts, et cetera. They have no problem doing OMO, although they just withdraw some liquidity today. But at the same time, I think there's very limited appetite for fiscal expansion as well. Last week, we all saw that the premier, Mr. Li, was quite concerned about the small and medium-sized company, situation here, and that he was proposing, especially for those that are in troubles, to postpone their tax payment by 3 months. So instead of a tax cut, we can see that the state council is now only authorized to postpone a tax payment. Today, just a few minutes ago, we saw the headlines saying that at the state council working meeting, the premier is suggesting doing more to pre-adjust for the policies for the difficult without giving any the sales. That there is, from a fiscal perspective, especially at the time when local governments are probably seeing more trouble selling land. The land sales receipts have dropped quite dramatically in third quarter as a result of the property sector, coming under pressure with double-digit sales contraction in year-on-year terms. So the last area that they could do something, but I think it's not fast enough, is on credit. So if they're not moving on monetary, if they're not moving on fiscal, the only hope is credit. If they can actually get two of these combined in combination working, let's say if they can move the credit fast enough and then combine it with fiscal, they can get away without interest rate cut or tripwire cut. It's no problem. But the reason why interest rates and the tripwire cuts are so important is, as we mentioned earlier, it is basically a signal that they are doing something. Everybody needs to do something. It's hard to imagine that, CBIRC and the Ministry of Finance would work, their heart out and 24/7 over this growth stabilization goal, while PBOC just take a backseat and say, okay, you guys go ahead and we're not going to cut anything. And we just sit here. So the reason why we think that they need to move on all three fronts is because that once they, from a centralized decision-making mechanism, once a decision is made for, going completely to the other direction, everybody needs to work on it, right? Just like the patch up we saw earlier this year on tightening, when we are going to see easing, it will be added together as well. So I would say that, theoretically, without a rate cut, we could be fine next year. We could even have higher than, 4 or 5% growth if they actually adjust the policies in time for fiscal and also credit. However, the problem is that with window guidance currently not being extremely effective and with property sectors under so much pressure, especially for private developers under so much liquidity crunch, the problem is that I highly suspect that without the rate cut, we won't have either the credit easing or the fiscal easing that is stimulus that we were hoping for. And therefore, our current forecast is that with incremental easing, it will turn out to be effective. We will see 4% growth next year. But if actually we are seeing, policymakers sitting on their hands, and the risk of us sliding towards our bear case scenario would be higher. In that bear case scenario, we have GDP growth for 2022 at 2.2%. So it could be very bad. Last thing I would just mention is implications on potential growth for such a paradigm shift. Everybody is talking about paradigm shift. Everybody by now has, realized this is the case. Mark has mentioned that with the demographics turning extremely negative on us, what exactly can we hang on to right by now? I think I'm actually not so worried about the demographics because the baby bust situation is seen almost everywhere these 2 years due to the pandemic. And China has longer term issues, but the impact on growth is extremely, minimal, because that's basically the headwind on growth will be roughly 0.1 to 0.2 percentage points at best. But what I am worried more about is actually the capital formation, or you can say that the investment component in potential growth, in driving potential growth. And the overall TFP is probably at the risk of dropping as well when this paradigm shift comes with too much policy, non-transparency. I'll stop there.
Thank you. So Stephen seemed a bit optimistic that conditions could improve. George seemed a bit skeptical. So I think you've added your voice to this debate. I thank you for that. Dave, so we'll go over an extra minute or two. Dave, please take your time, offer your thoughts on what you've heard today.
Sure. As I was listening to this conversation, I felt myself as a former government official pitying the poor Chinese official out in the provinces, the localities. Moving away from a GDP target makes your life really difficult, right? That if, in the past, and Helen talked about, now we're in the great reshuffle as everyone is trying to figure out what their next job is. You know, in the past, if it was just hitting the target, you hit the target and you looked pretty good. But now you've got to, you know, there are other things out there. There's carbon emissions. There, you know, all sorts of other potential measures you've got to hit. And it's more highly centralized, right? So it makes life much more difficult. And I think you're going to see a lot of the policy paralysis at local levels, problems kicked upstairs, things that creative officials could have solved in a different environment. It's just going to create problems on the ground. And I think you'll see a lot of that, you know, people complaining about, you know, one size fits all policies and you know, headaches being kicked up the chain. On the questions about how the U.S. should respond, have COVID measures become non-tariff barriers? You know, before the audience jumped on, we were having the usual conversation among people who deal with China about, have you been able to get back into China? And so there are lots of things, whether intentional or not, becoming barriers, not necessarily to exports, but just to doing business. And I think that is partly intentional, partly unintentional, but I think Beijing is not disappointed. For example, I don't think they're disappointed that people aren't going to be able to go, international visitors aren't going to be able to go to the Olympics. It advances the inward turning that Xi Jinping already is inclined to. I think it was Munir asked about, would this be a good time for the U.S. to roll out some kind of strategy or economic policy towards Southeast Asia? I think almost any time would be a good time for us to do that. I'm pessimistic that we will do it, but for a long time, I think the region has wanted more than just U.S. security commitment. A security commitment's important, but you know, whether it's TPP or something that sounds like TPP or acts like TPP but is more palatable. But it's, you know, in Washington, it's hard to see what that would be at this point when both parties are now sort of shifting away from the concept that trade has been good for the United States. And then finally, Jean-Remy, you asked, you know, does the sort of consensus on assertiveness towards China cause problems for American policymakers? I think you saw, you know, Janet Yellen made news the other day by saying maybe we should try to get rid of some of the tariffs that have been bad for the United States. And, you know, that the fact that that made news tells you just how complicated it is. Even the dumb tariffs that the U.S. has put in place that clearly don't go at national security sectors that serve only to as a drag on the U.S. economy. That is an issue of controversy in the U.S. Tells you where we are, and I think it really does limit the flexibility of policymakers. And I think what you're seeing over the next year, you know, the fact that if you're watching American politics, the Republican Party did fairly well in yesterday's elections in the United States. Presumably 2024, that's a signal that the midterm elections, the Republicans are likely to do well. And so it's going to, I think, entrench those policy contradictions. Unwillingness of the Biden administration to take any chances on a more reasoned approach on some issues, and it's just going to make extend some of the problems we have. Mark, with that, I will kick it back to you. Thanks.
Well, thank you. So this has been an excellent discussion. We could have gone on for much longer, very wide-ranging discussion. It shows that following developments in China is never boring and never clear cut to many of us. So I want to thank our excellent panelists and discussants and the audience for joining us today. A great discussion. Thank you once again.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.